Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the Daily French Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer. And today I'm joined by Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you doing?
Well, I'm excited to be on with Beki Mahlobo, as I call him, Uhayek. So, it's great to have him here. It's always an honor. I'm just excited.
And of course, the legendary Mr. Beki Mahlobo himself. Beki, how are you doing today?
How's it, Nick? Thanks for having me on, Herman. I thought that nickname was only supposed to be between the two of us. Now the whole world knows.
Damn it. This is why I will never be good in the conspiracy theories, because I always think, oh, this is something to share with the world. I'd be blogging a conspiracy.
And then Bush told me about the holographic airplanes. Anyway. Let's not go down that rabbit hole, and let us instead start with something that the South African Reserve Bank has said recently. So, in the South African Reserve Bank's June quarterly bulletin, they have warned that debt servicing costs need to be contained as a top priority if the financial sustainability of South Africa is to be achieved. The South African Reserve Bank said that government needs to rein in its debt service, as they're draining financial resources away from other areas that require government support and threaten the nation's fiscal stability. Quote, for government to continue providing the necessary social and economic services while attaining fiscal sustainability, the growth in debt service costs need to be contained as a top priority, primarily through the debt-containing measures. Beki, when the Reserve Bank starts saying things like this, firstly, is this the first time that they've said this? And secondly, when they start saying things like this, is it time to start running around screaming and setting our hair on fire?
Yeah, Nick, so this is not the first time that the South African Reserve Bank has flagged South Africa's debt levels. The first time they did so was earlier on this year through the financial stability report that they published, essentially warning that South African government that debt servicing costs are essentially getting out of hand and are starting to take away from other operations which the government needs to essentially pay for, such as that of education, policing, and so forth. Our debt servicing costs, as they currently stand now, are sitting.
Sorry, can I just ask what exactly is debt servicing costs for those who are uninitiated?
Debt servicing costs is essentially the amount of money that the government. It's the interest on the debt. It's the amount that the government needs to pay on the principal. It's the interest on debt. And if you look at South Africa, we added about 20% to our debt levels when looking at government debt to GDP in 1 year, 2020. And that increased the risk of South African bonds. Every time the South African government takes on more debt, it leads to an increase in interest rates, which leads to an increase in debt servicing costs. And that's exactly what we have seen. Our debt servicing costs right now are essentially taken away from other operations of government, like I mentioned earlier. Now, the risk is that if you're looking at it from a financial point of perspective, it, as much as the interest on government bonds is increasing, it incentivizes investors to buy government bonds because it's a high return. Currently sitting, South African bonds are sitting at 9%. That's higher compared to other countries around the world, as well as developed markets like the United States, as well as Germany, where interest government bond yields are sitting at 1% towards like zero. So owning a South African government bond gives you a high a return or basically on you loaning your money to the government. But then that also creates a financial risk, because we've seen that certain financial institutions in South Africa, as well as commercial banks, as well as pension funds, have been buying South African bonds. And that creates a financial systemic risk, meaning that if the government were to default on those bonds, then it could create a financial crisis in South Africa, which is something that the South African Reserve Bank has flagged in its financial stability report.
So what exactly does a financial crisis look like practically? I mean, is everyone going to go bankrupt at once? Does the rand fall over? Are we able to buy things in the shops? What would happen, do you think?
Yeah, so a financial crisis would take place in the sense of banks essentially becoming bankrupt, not having enough funds to pay off their obligations to their customers. Like whenever you go to a bank and you put your money in the bank, the bank loans it out and tries to get a greater return on its investment. It invests either by loaning out that money or by buying government bonds. So whenever the South African government defaults on those payments, it then unfortunately negatively impacts you as a South African citizen.
Right. So Herman, we've talked about the debt many times on the show, but it really does seem like we are kind of inching slowly towards that great point of crisis. Now, we have seen a little bit of positive development in the sense that SAA is being sold, although, of course, there are problems with that deal, as we talked about on a previous episode. But do you think we're anywhere closer really to properly fixing the debt problem in South Africa?
Nope.
Could you explain your reasoning?
Yes. Okay, no, I'll stop being a pedant. Right, so there are five sources of income for any state. Tax revenue, cutting expenditure from existing, so the reallocation of existing revenue, the printing of more money, the seizing of assets, or the borrowing of money. And in South Africa, we really have the problem, and I've made this point many, many, many times before. The South African taxpayer is immensely heavily taxed by world standards. So there's no scope to up the revenue intake through, you know, just turning the screws on the taxpayer more tightly. We can't borrow money from overseas. Well, we can, but it's really a risky bit because we have, you know, we've got junk status. Creditors really would be taking a massive gamble with South Africa. Then we can't. We can print money. That's a very, very dangerous thing because it just releases inflation. Simple. If you have the more of something you have, the less scarce it is, so the less valuable it is. So if you're going to up the money supply significantly, you're essentially diluting the purchasing power of your currency. So we can't get money that way. We can try to seize assets. That's, I think, a very key motivating factor behind NHI. Ideas like prescribed assets, EWC, essentially just whenever the government is trying to create distance between you and an asset, that might be them trying to bail out the system. And then there's the fifth one, which is the real problem, is just, you know, cut expenditure. I remember watching a program, what was it? It was about that news station. It was written by Aaron Sorkin, the guy who wrote The West Wing. It was about, you know, reporting the news honestly. Oh, it just escapes me now. But the point
obviously
is, it was
more,
about...
You're more cultured than us, Herman.
What was it? Anyhow, the point is, it's about this fictitious news station where the actors or the characters try to the newsroom. I mean, what a creative title for me to forget. But the newsroom, one character in the newsroom once said that she gets so annoyed when people say that balancing a budget is like managing the household budget. It's like saying that parking a car is similar to parking, you know, the lunar rover module or something. And then I'm like, yes, but you're still parking something. I mean, there are still firm parallels here. Don't hit things. Be stable. Look where you're going. I mean, it's not a perfect analogy, but the fundamentals remain the same. If you are a household in debt, you stop spending money on things you can't afford.
Right.
And then you get to that point where you take in more money than you spend. And the government should do that because the problem currently is that we're just spending and spending and spending. And even though Minister Mboweni tried to, you know, close the tap slightly, the political will just isn't there to do it because of what is currently being financed through that money. And just to give you a bit of a context here, is in 20... 2020-2021, in that financial year, SARS expects to have, or has, I think the figures will still come out accurately and might be revised, but they revenue contributing from a company income tax, CIT, was 204 billion rand. So essentially, in South Africa, we could have scrapped company, CIT, company income tax, and still have 30 billion rands to spare if we didn't have to pay, the interest on these, on the debt we've incurred. I don't know if I'm making sense, but it's just to give you some idea of the scale of this thing. We could have cut company income tax with money to spare if we hadn't gotten ourselves into this debt situation.
Right, and of course, if our debt was lower, I mean, currently we're spending what, about the same as the education budget on just interest? Wouldn't it be nice to have another entire education budget worth of money to spend?
To just contextualize it, these smart schools cost about 100 million rand. Panyaza Lusufi loves them. They are smart schools, high tech, the best equipment in the world. 100 million. I think if my calculations are correct, we could have built 2,300 smart schools if Pravin Gordhan Malusi Gigaba and the whoever nutcases decided wasting taxpayer money is a good thing. We could have built thousands of the best schools in the world if we didn't have to service this debt.
Could I add 2 points of concern for the average South African in terms of debt servicing costs and South Africa's increase in debt servicing costs? The first one is that, which was stated by the South African Reserve Bank, and stated that if South Africa is to stabilize its debt levels currently at 80% or sitting or about 89% in the next 3 years, it would need to run a budget surplus of about 2%, a primary budget surplus, that is. And that means that it doesn't take into account debt servicing costs. So excluding debt servicing costs, South Africa needs to run a primary budget surplus of about 2% and needs to have a GDP growth level of about 2-3% in order to stabilize debt at that level. That means that debt stays at that level, doesn't increase, doesn't decrease, just staying at that level.
We currently have a deficit of how much?
No, we're currently running, as of last year, a consolidated deficit of about 14% as a proportion of GDP.
So we're very need far to, away from that surplus.
Yeah, we're extremely far away from that surplus. So we would need to completely revamp and go the other route, 180 degree, in order to achieve that primary surplus of about 2%. And not only that, but that needs to be combined with a growth rate of about 2-3%. You can only get that with reform policies that enable growth levels in the country. That's the first point of concern. So I don't see us achieving that anytime soon, which means that South Africa's debt servicing costs could increase in the future, as well as our debt levels. The second thing to consider is that whenever interest rates, because that's what we're talking about when you're looking at debt servicing costs, how much does it cost the government to pay off its debt, is increasing for the government. It also increases for businesses in the sense of, when banks look at government bonds, they also factor it in when they're loaning out money to businesses. If the government is loaning out at a rate of 9%, the bank might be less inclined to loan to the business that might be loaning at a less interest rate. So the banks need to increase interest rates for these businesses in order for these investments to become more lucrative. And essentially, businesses need to cough up more money in order for to take out loans in terms of interest rates. So it increases interest rates in the country, making business investments less competitive otherwise than they would have been. So that's unfortunately the consequences of debt servicing costs, is that it sucks away investment from other avenues in the South African economy and completely puts it in the state's coffers.
And as we know, once it gets into state coffers, it very often makes its way into the hands of politically connected cadres and gets then spent on expensive whiskey. And, expensive whiskey is nice, but it's not so great when we have 40% of the population without a job. Yeah, so this is not a good situation. It is one we will obviously continue to watch and report on and explain. And it's important that South Africans do know about this. Herman, I think your dog is causing chaos in the background because I keep hearing smashing noises.
No, that's just the economy. I think I'm right. I quickly Googled this, and I think I'm broadly right that the debt servicing cost accounts for is the equivalent of a fifth of all the revenue that SARS collected in 2020-2021. So one in every five rands that SARS collected from the taxpayer is useless for this country. If I compare it here, it's more than 50% of personal income tax. It's more than two-thirds of value-added tax. As I said before, it's in total more than the net company income tax. It's just an astounding number. And people think that you can borrow and borrow and borrow until you borrow your way out of a crisis. But the thing here is that we have to look at this with just the cold logic of money and budget. You can't keep on relying on clever Keynesian theories of artificially extending what a state is able to afford.
Right. We've seen examples of other economies that are of similar size to ours or similar prestige in the world attempting to do the same thing that we're doing now. And they did not end well, as we know. Zimbabwe, Venezuela, all those kind of places. Anyway, let us move on to another story, which is, I think, connected to this in a broad way. There's an app or a service called Sweep South, which connects employers to domestic workers so that they can. It's kind of like the Uber of domestic workers. I think it was how it was described earlier in our discussions. And they did a survey of people who use their app to find work, to ask them how much they were being paid. They also surveyed people who did not use their app as well. And according to their responses from 7,000 domestic workers, they say that a significant percentage of these workers earned between 2,614 Rand and 916 Rand, which is below minimum wage as of March the 1st, 2021. The report also showed that 21% of domestic workers earned less than 1,500 Rand a month, while only 1% earned above 6,000 a month. So I will say first up that I think that there's often problems with trusting these kind of self-reporting survey things. I think in general, it's not just about wages. It's about basically any time that people self-report things. You often get pretty bad data from that. But with that said, it doesn't sound too crazy a result. I think that this is probably reasonably accurate. And as the headline of the news article I pulled this from suggested, this is below what it called a living wage in South Africa. So this is a critique of South Africa that's often brought up by our friends on the left, who will point out, you know, there's many South Africans who are not getting paid enough to sustain their lives or their families and basically are forced into absolute poverty through these jobs. So, Herman, let me start with you. Why are these wages so low? Why has minimum wage not been able to lift them up? And what is a way of lifting up these wages, perhaps without damaging the economy? I'm going to ask Becky the same question, so don't hog all the good answers.
With Becky on a podcast about economics and fiscal policy, it's impossible to hog the good answers because he'll always come up with something, you know, 10 times better than anything you can say. So the first question is, why is this the case? I'm not quite sure, but I suspect if the survey takes data from the period of, you know, 2020, then there might be something in the fact that we lost 34% of our middle class during 2020. So a third of our most reliable consumer base just wiped out. Many of these people, of course, the employers of domestic help, probably the most reliable employer of domestic help. So that could be a contributing factor. Beyond people falling out of the middle class, of course, there's the squeeze on the middle class. So there might be quote unquote illegal lowering of wages by people, you know, agreeing to work for cheaper than is perhaps demanded by the domestic service sector minimum wage. But in general, I do think that it's a flow through from an unhealthy economy, that there's simply not enough money to meet the high demands of and so often impractical demands of a minimum wage. So that brings me on to the second question. I can't exactly remember what it was, but it was about the minimum wage.
Yeah, why isn't the minimum wage working to fix this?
Oh, okay, yes. The simple answer is you can't legislate someone out of poverty. The real key to a healthy economy is productivity. And productivity is very narrowly weaved into the idea of purchasing power. So it doesn't help that you've got a lot of money, but the money is useless, so you don't have purchasing power. And that can't be changed by government making a new law or a new rule. Productivity and purchasing power is based on whether people are putting into the economy what other people are willing and able to pay to get out of the economy. So if you're going to try and manipulate the system, it is like trying to legislate the weather. You don't have control over the elements determining the things you're trying to affect, yet you are trying to affect second or third order consequences of a problem that is actually related to something completely different. The minimum wage, I think, is morally probably the easiest policy to defend, but the best study I've ever read on it actually said that, you know, minimum wage, no minimum wage, it doesn't really make a difference. In terms of whether it makes the poorest income brackets wealthier. But what it does do is it makes those people more vulnerable in the event of an economic downturn, because you cannot self-correct. You cannot, if you're a business under strain, say to your entire workforce, guys, it's going badly. Can I please cut my salary by half, cut yours by 20%, just so that we can keep afloat, get through this rut, and get out the other side? I promise you, we will grow back to where we need to be and beyond. The minimum wage make that kind of responsible reaction to crisis impossible. It is sort of like strapping an old person into a Zimmer frame. The Zimmer frame might be useful, but it doesn't help that you completely make the person dependent on something that could go wrong and actually cause them to fall over. So why is this the case? You can't legislate people out of poverty. Lastly, what should be done? Well, make the minimum wage voluntary or opt out. You can say there's a minimum wage and we encourage people to do that, and there can be benefits in terms of tax or productivity or whatever if people adhere to that. But you cannot have a punitive system where you actually say to two people willing to enter a contract where they both get what they need from it, have the government come in and say, oh, no, I'd rather have you have no job than a job. I'd rather have you have no income than a low income. And it's sort of skewed by the problem of entry-level work, youth unemployment, making it more difficult to judge holistically, because entry-level work is less skilled and also lower paid. But if you want to fix this problem of proper wages, the way to do it is not to try and control the weather. It is actually to plant where it's raining.
Very poetically said. Becky, I put the same set of questions to you, and also let me phrase the last one a different way. If we all lived under the benevolent guidance of His Imperial Majesty, Mr. Mohlobo the First, what would you do to raise wages across the country? Because I think it's not just domestic workers who suffer from this issue. There are many sectors where people are paid very poorly. How would we raise wages in South Africa in a way that doesn't hurt the economy or infringe on freedoms?
Yeah. So firstly, I'd like to say that Herman took all of the good answers away. So the only way out of this is, I'm going to echo what Herman said. The only way out of this is really to make people more wealthy. How you do that is to make the economy more wealthy. In other words, you need to increase the productivity of South Africa. You need to implement policies that enable growth, that enable businesses to essentially operate and expand, essentially. And what we see is that in countries that have strong institutions, such as that of property rights, and have policies that enable businesses to go about their daily operations, see wages increase. These are countries such as that of the United States. A domestic worker in the United States earns more than a domestic worker here in South Africa. And the difference between the two of those countries are the policies that are implemented in those two different set of countries. So that's exactly what's needed here in South Africa, is that you need to implement these policies that firstly strengthen the institutions that protect private property in the country, allow businesses to easily start up and operate how they'd like to operate, and increase investments in the country. So you'd need to see an increase in investment levels in the country. Currently, South Africa's investment levels are sitting about 15%. If you look at a gross fixed cap formation as a portion of GDP, that's a decline from 2007 of about 26%, with basically undoing the successes of our early administration from 1994 until 2007, that period. And what you find in that period is that the policies that were in much of the psyche of the ANC have been that of wealth destruction, as well as that of stagnant economic growth, which leads to a country experiencing low wage earning in South Africa. So to answer your question then, Nick, is that we need policies that enable the country to become more wealthy. We need policies that enable a growing of the middle income class. And a point that Herman, that I'm actually proud he mentioned here, is that he mentioned that of purchasing power. You know, unfortunately, a lot of these low income earning people don't have a buffer when in times of crisis. Whenever, unfortunately, for example, the year 2020, they are the first ones to be cut off from the workforce. That's exactly what we saw last year. And now looking at the increase in consumer prices, where certain items have increased by 30%, the first people that feel that impact are those ones in low income earning categories.
I'd also like to add something else to the mix, and this applies to a lot of professions, not just domestic work. But I think we are also kind of missing a trick here. If we think that if we envision domestic work as something that someone is supposed to make their entire career out of, and this is a problem that I think in a lot of first world countries as well, where people complain about minimum wage jobs like in fast food or something like that not being able to sustain them. Ideally, when an economy is healthy and there's a lot of job opportunities available, something like domestic work, something like working in a fast food restaurant, this should be a starter entry-level position. It should be something that people do maybe while they're doing something else or temporarily to kind of boost their own income. And then eventually they use the money they make from that to either put themselves through education, skills development, or they find another job or something like that. And you're never going to get a country that's wealthy, middle class, and safe if it's entirely domestic workers, even if they're all earning 6,000 rand a month, because it's kind of a little bit of a dead end in some ways, unless you're also developing yourself on the side. And that's why, you know, we need better education system and things like that, so that people can do these jobs as temporary work. Work as a domestic worker, maybe while you're in university, you do it part-time, you make some money to supplement yourself, maybe pay off some of your education. Or maybe you even do live in domestic work for a while you're studying for something else, and then you would move on to perhaps a higher paying job.
But yeah, so can I add just one more point there, Nick?
Yeah.
So such things as like minimum wage would prevent that university student from getting that job and upskilling themselves.
Right.
I think that's exactly what we're trying to say here, is that these policies that dress themselves to be that of good intention actually have the opposite effect. Sure, the people that benefit from that only might see an increase in their wages, but the great majority of South Africans are not going to tap into that. Like, we have a youth unemployment rate of 75%. That's exactly. Extraordinary. That's extraordinary.
If I could have a parting shot here, I think one thing that people should think about is the economy is not a machine, it's an ecosystem. And if we're going to look at a modern economy, that's more classic liberal rather than libertarian. Think about a zoo, and what animals Because in a zoo, essentially, you want to keep animals that would, in natural circumstances, die out alive because there's an emotional or a moral value there. And it's similar to sort of not the laissez-faire capitalism, is you want to keep certain sectors of certain jobs alive that, if left to completely brutal circumstances, would go extinct. You cannot, through the minimum wage, say all impalas must now have this level of weight. You cannot control an ecosystem through fiat. You can try to manipulate it and to make it safer and build a Kruger Park where these, you know, where there's a vibrant enclosed ecosystem, but you cannot see the economy as something that you can replace, turn off, or calibrate in any significant way. And we saw the folly of that last year.
Exactly.
And we will continue to see the folly.
When we were prevented from buying open-toed shoes. Anyway, that is all the time we have for today. Thank you very much. If you want to support the Institute of Race Relations, which brings you the Daily Friend Show, please SMS your name to 32823. And we'll see you tomorrow for the next episode of the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.